Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone if you'd like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Katie Matthews. Ma'am, you may begin.
Yomi, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining this call today regarding NOAA and NASA's release of annual climate temperature and other global information for the year 2015. My name is Katie Matthews, and I am the Communications and Outreach Branch Chief at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, and I'll be helping to facilitate the call today. Today, we're going to feature a presentation followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. You can find a copy of the presentation in a variety of ways, one through a link in the NOAA Media Advisory or in the NASA press release, which you can find at the top of nasa.gov/earth. You can also find it directly on the website www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. Today we have two presenters. Our first presenter is Gavin Schmidt, Director of NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City. And our second presenter is Tom Carl, Director of NOAA National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina, and Chair of the Subcommittee on Global Change Research. After the two presenters, we'll come back for the operator-assisted question and answer session. I will now turn this over to Gavin to start the presentation. Gavin?
Thank you very much. This is Gavin Schmidt of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. We're going to present our annual global analysis of 2015. The bottom line, as you can see and has been well trailed before, is that 2015 was by far the warmest year in the records that we have put together. If you move to slide two, you can see the pattern of warming over the over 2015 over the globe. Our value for 2015 was 0.87 degrees C above our nominal 1951 to 1980 baseline. If you take that baseline to be the 19th century, 1880 to 1899, it's the first year that's 1 degree C above that baseline. Just a couple of things about how we put these data sets together. This is a product, it's an analysis that uses raw data from weather stations across the globe, including Antarctica and almost everywhere else, and combined with ship measurements and buoy measurements of ocean temperatures, again, across the globe. That means that you need to interpolate a little bit to fill in missing data. You need to account for a number of issues with inhomogeneities in the weather station and ocean data. And our analysis then depends a little bit on those assumptions as well. Some of the differences between our analyses are related to those kinds of choices, but the underlying raw data is basically the same. 2015 was by far the warmest year in the record, beating 2014, which was the previous record, by about 0.13 degrees Celsius, which is above the error in measurement that we have in any particular year. Tom?
Thank you, Gavin. This is Tom Carl, Director of National Centers for Environmental Information. I wanted to turn your attention to slide three. As Gavin mentioned, 2015 clearly was the warmest year on record. Similarly, in our data set, we were by far warmer than any other year, breaking the temperature set previously in 2014, last year, by over a quarter of a degree Fahrenheit. But what you see on slide two is trying to put in perspective just how warm or cold it was spatially throughout the globe. And what we have here is colored grid cells, that's areas of the globe, that were either record warm or much warmer than average, going all the way to, you can actually find one grid cell in the North Atlantic, in fact, two grid cells that were coldest on record. But by and far, the big story here is record warmth that was spread throughout the world. You can see All the oceans participated, from the tropical Atlantic, Pacific, the Indian Ocean, many continental areas, including South America, Central America, Asia, Europe. We actually had, for our land temperatures, they were, in fact, they broke the all-time warmest temperatures by a larger degree than any other record that we have had in the past. So, again, the message on slide three, the warmth was spread throughout the globe with some important exceptions, notably the North Atlantic, where we have long periods of record. And you saw on Gavin's data set where more interpolation is done, there were some cool areas in the southern, extreme southern oceans. The data there doesn't go quite far back as we have with other data sets, and that's why you don't see it on this slide three. So with that, why don't I turn over to Gavin for slide four?
So people have been asking a lot about what are the contributing factors to this very warm year that we've just had, and it's worth exploring a little bit how the conditions in the tropical Pacific, the El Nino signal that you see there, has been contributing to annual mean temperatures. So this is a graph that color codes individual months since 1980 with respect to whether there was an El Nino declared or whether there was a La Nina, which is the opposite cool phase in the tropical Pacific. And what you can see by focusing on the areas that are in red, that when we do have an El Nino event going on, we do see a progressive warming of the global mean temperature. And you can see that in almost all of the cases, the El Nino starts and then the annual temperature responds maximally about 6 months, 4 months to 6 months afterwards. And so that's that was true in 82, 83. It was true in 97, 98, also in 2010, and is also true in 2015. But the interesting thing is that 2015 did not start with an El Nino event in the tropical Pacific. The warmth of 2015 was warm right from the beginning, and the last few months of 2015, particularly October, November, and December, were record warm anomalies for any months in the records themselves. And so they're really reacting to the current El Nino. We actually anticipate that because of that delay that I mentioned, that 2016, because it's starting with a very strong El Nino, and then it will kind of build during the year. 2016 is expected to be again an exceptionally warm year, and perhaps even another record. Whether the record is due to El Nino, if you can see the trend over time, regardless of the El Nino or La Nina phase, the trend over time is why we're having a record warm year. If this was just an El Nino year, it would be like the other years. The reason why this is such a warm record year is because of the long-term underlying trend. And there is no evidence that long-term trend has slowed, paused, or hiatused at any point in the last few decades. Tom?
Okay, thank you, Gavin. Going on to slide five and continuing on to the point that Gavin just made about, you know, what do we see when we step back and take a look at the overall changes in time. If you look at figure five, you see each decade where the temperatures are colored, those blocks. And you can see since 1970, you know, each decade is warmer than the previous decade. And you can see where we sit the first 5 years into the most recent decade, and it's continuing that progressive pattern. And it's interesting to note that this year we now have for the first time a year that's well more than a degree Celsius higher than the mean temperatures of the last 20 years of the 19th century. So it's 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the 20th century average, but it's over a degree Celsius warmer than what we saw the average of the last 20 years of the 19th century. That's fairly substantial. And if you take a look at, you know, what we've seen since 1970, lots of different statistical and sophisticated mathematical analysis have been done on this data. And basically, you come away with a rise of temperature somewhere between 0.1 and 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade, depending on how you want to slice it and dice it. And overall, you know, about a 0.15 degrees C per decade warming since about 1970. So clearly, the 2015 data continues the pattern we've seen over the last 4 to 5 decades. Gavin?
One of the questions that that often comes up is, what are the differences between the various analyses that are out there, and how do the adjustments that need to be made to deal with non-climatic issues actually impact the record that we have? So here we have a comparison of three of those estimates. So from us, NASA GISTEMP, from Tom's NOAA record, and also from the UKMO, the HAD crew record, which has also been released this morning, this afternoon, UK time, I guess. And you can see there is some variation among the graphs. You know, it's around 0.1 degrees C difference based on differences in interpolation, differences in how you deal with missing data, different ways of dealing with inhomogeneities in the stations. But you can see that all three of those curves show very, very similar overall trends. And in fact, all three of them, for the first time this year, show more than 1 degree C above the 19th century average. There's one additional line on here, which is the blue line that you can see, which is the estimate of the global mean temperature without taking any non-climatic adjustments into it. So there's no adjustments there. There's been no corrections of any sort. And so what you see is that by making the corrections that we have to make in order to have a climatic record, we're actually reducing the trend that you would have otherwise inferred over time. And I think that that is something that that really doesn't get enough attention, because you know, people think that that adjusting data is somehow a terrible thing. You have to take the raw data and deal with the inhomogeneities and the problems with that data, because no data set is perfect, whether it's any weather station or the ocean buoys or even satellites. And so I'd be happy to discuss that a little bit further in the Q&A, perhaps. Tom?
Thanks, Gavin. On slide 7, what that slide tries to do is to give you a better feeling for just how unusual this year was compared to the previous years. We have both in the NOAA and NASA data set quite a large separation from the previous record, which was just last year. And you can see in previous times when we've set records, the gap between the previous record and the new record, it has been substantially smaller than what we've seen this year. So that's the rather remarkable part of the story, we think, this year. And you can see both the NASA and NOAA data sets are pretty darn close in terms of the way we're scoring it, differing only by a few hundredths of a degree Fahrenheit. So with that, Gavin, let me switch it over back. Oh, no, I'm going to take the next one. Let's move on to number 8. So number 8 shows a – this is slide 8 – shows a an example, well, not example, shows and illustrates how the record unfolded this past year. And you can see that, you know, we broke the record each month for the warmest month on record, except for 2 months. So 10 of the 12 months had the warmest global temperatures. 2 months, January and April, we did not break the previous record. And that's the first time we've seen that, 10 out of the 12 months breaking the all-time previous high global average temperature. And you can see in December and recent months in the autumn, the records had been broken by a substantial margin, much stronger than what we saw earlier in the year. And as Gavin mentioned earlier, it's going to be very difficult for that not to continue into at least the first part of next year because, in particular, the ocean temperatures are so warm. So, Gavin, let me go over to you now on slide 9.
So this is a bit of a confused graph, but it gives you a sense of how the record stacked up over the year as well in the NASA GIST temp record. 2015 is the solid red that you're seeing there. And then we've also got 2010 and 2014, which are now years 2 and years 3 in our ranking. And you can see that they all started off quite warm. The green dotted line was the record anomaly for every individual month in our record. And so in our record, we didn't actually break the records for the individual month until June. July was very close, but then you can see October, November, December really just blowing the records away. But 2015 was the warmest year because it was warm throughout the year, and even though it's kind of picking up that El Nino assist in the last 3 months, even without El Nino, this would have been the warmest year on record. So we're really looking at a long-term trend that this is just a symptom of that long-term trend. And therefore, we anticipate that this is going to be continuing because the factors that are causing this long-term trend are continuing to accelerate. And that's mainly the increasing burning of fossil fuels and the carbon dioxide emissions that go with that. Tom.
Okay, thanks, Gavin. Going on to the last slide in our package, this is slide 10. A lot of times questions come up, well, you've talked about the surface temperatures, what's going on higher up in the atmosphere. I might mention the reason why we emphasize and regularly record on what's going on at the surface, I think it's fairly obvious. That's where we live, that's where we work, that's where we grow our food. And so there's a lot of critical impacts that are important with respect to surface temperature. Nonetheless, it is important to try and understand how the temperature is changing throughout the atmosphere. And this diagram tries to put that in perspective using a number of different data sets and looking at different layers of the atmosphere. And, you know, we've got a couple of different data sets that are focused only on the satellite data. You see some acronyms, UAH, that's the University of Alabama at Huntsville. We see UW-UAH because the University of Washington then puts a correction or adjustment to try and remove some of the influences of the stratosphere and the kind of the weighting functions you have to use to produce these data. Remote sensing systems is another data set here. And again, University of Washington group tries to remove some of the weighting in the higher levels of the atmosphere so it truly reflects the middle of the troposphere. And then in NOAA, there's a group that actually has a whole different procedure of how to correct the satellite data with overpasses at the pole to try and ensure that there's homogeneity in the data. And as Gavin mentioned early on, all of these data, if you don't correct them, you can't make any sense out of them. So in essence, for 2015, for both the lower troposphere, the latter is the bottom half of the atmosphere, and the middle of the atmosphere, 2015 was not a record, although if you look at the weather balloon data, you can find some levels, generally at the lower levels of the atmosphere, where we did see warmest temperatures on record. Typically, what we see in the atmosphere is a stronger response to an El Nino than what we see at the surface. And that response tends to be manifested more strongly in the year after the advent of an El Nino. So you would expect in 2016 to see the biggest signal with respect to this El Nino on that temperature record. So, again, the takeaway message is no record in general for the layers of the atmosphere substantially above the surface, but stay tuned for 2015. So with that, I guess I'll turn it back over to Katie for questions.
Thanks, Tom. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. After the operator calls on you, please indicate who you would like to answer the question, if possible. Yomi, could I ask you to please remind participants how they can ask a question and please queue up the first call?
Thank you. At this time, we'll begin the question-answer session. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your first and last name clearly when prompted. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment to see if we have any questions. Our first question comes from Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. You may begin.
Yes, and thank you for doing this. I got a question for both Gavin and Tom. Starting with Gavin, going, you said obviously there was no sign of a pause or slowing. Later on, you said acceleration, and when I look at slide 5, granted that's NOAA data, it does look like it. Is this an actual acceleration, or is this more steady? How would you characterize the last decade, 5 years, whatever you prefer, in terms of the rate? Is it steady or accelerating or decelerating? And for Tom, looking at slide 6, the uncorrected, is it fair to say even with the uncorrected it is a record, to sort of satisfy the, oh, my God, you're fiddling with everything, people?
Okay, I'll take the first part of that. With short-term records, there's a lot of intra-annual variability, and it's hard to get a very clear view on whether a particular trend is slightly higher or slightly longer. You know, I did an analysis yesterday. If you take the trends to 1997, so before the big El Nino peak in 1998, and then you just continue that forward, we are now above where we would have expected in 1997, just extrapolating forward. But we're not very far above that. So I think it's appropriate to call that a steady warming over that time period. And there's no evidence, like I said, of any change in the long-term trend over that period.
And Tom?
I think that's absolutely right, Seth. Regardless of whether you correct the data or not, if you just plot the raw data, you still get a record in 2015, regardless.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. Our next question comes from Justin Gillis with the New York Times. You may begin, sir.
Yes. Gentlemen, thank you for doing this. Could I ask you to return to this question of the satellite record or lack of record, I suppose. Is that surprising to have a year this warm at the surface and not have a record in the satellite data? And what are plausible physical explanations for it? Or alternatively, you know, should we be worried about that's something going on we don't understand?
Yeah, I can take a first crack, and I know Gavin is going to have some comments, but I can tell you that, you know, we expect about a 50% stronger response in the atmosphere to El Nino, and actually the the tropospheric record, which is the atmospheric temperatures in the atmosphere, they're much more affected by El Niños and La Niñas. In fact, if you look at that figure we provided, take a look at 2010, and again, you see from the figure that Gavin discussed, the warmth occurs after the beginning of the subsequent calendar year. So I think it would be very interesting in 2016 if we found that there was very little response in the satellite and weather balloon data to this El Nino. That would make for a very interesting science question. But the anticipation is that in 2016, the middle part of the atmosphere should respond. Now, that doesn't mean that we understand all the little bumps and wiggles in that temperature record, but certainly with respect to El Nino, the response, the strongest response is expected, should be this calendar year. Gavin?
So I'll second that. My analysis actually suggests that the size of the El Nino effect in the satellite data should be about twice as large as in the surface. And there's some interesting reasons for that. And one of the other things is that it's also a little bit more delayed as a signal compared to the signal at the surface. So you have maybe like a 4 or 5 month lag for the MSU data for the El Nino to really register. And this is really a function of, the poles versus the tropics and how homogeneous the tropics are within the atmosphere, whereas they're not quite so homogeneous at the surface. There are other issues that come up because we can correct for the El Nino effect, and we still see a divergence in the satellite temperature to the surface data, not so much with the balloon data anymore. Those are the kind of things that make scientists go, huh, and try and dive in a little bit more deeply. One of the issues that we've always had, though, is with the satellite records, there are more systematic errors that can affect the long-term trends, whether it's related to orbital drift or timing or how they correct for the diurnal cycle changes. Those are things which, you make a decision early on in the analysis and then you're kind of stuck with it. And so whether that's the right decision for the whole analysis, whether there's been changes both in instrumentation and putting together the new AMSU data from about 2005 onwards compared to the old MSU data. Those are things that people are exploring continuously. No data set is perfect. Where we see different data sets suggesting slightly different things, that's an interesting scientific question for us to be diving into.
Yeah, if I could add just another item here as well, one thing I thought it would be worthwhile to mention is we do have a data set that incorporates satellite data at the surface, and that's for sea surface temperatures. That's the daily, it's called the Daily Optimal Interpolated Sea Surface Temperature Data Set. The daily data set there, again, shows this year being the warmest on record, and that does have a rather characteristic pattern, very much similar to analyzing those sea surface temperatures without the satellite data.
Thank you.
Thank you, speakers. Our next question comes from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News.
Hi there. I have two quick questions for you. One is, if you had to give odds for 2016 setting another record, what would they be? And then the other question I had was, what are the consequences of the atmosphere heating up in 2016?
Are you a betting man, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I think, probably both Gavin and I would say the odds favor 2016. I don't want to speak for Gavin, but it's going to be 2016 is if you're going to be betting, you'd bet that it's going to be warmer than 2015.
Yeah, I concur. I'd give you better than evens that would be the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what are the consequences of the atmosphere heating up?
Are there some fallout to it?
Yeah, I was going to say one of the items that we haven't talked much about is, you know, as the atmosphere heats up, there's more water vapor, more latent heat of condensation as a lot of this water evaporates from the oceans. And so there will obviously be important implications with respect to the amount of precipitation and where it falls. And I know we haven't talked much about that, but that clearly is one of the important effects of increasing atmospheric temperature, the related increase in moisture. You know, again, it's very hard to pin down, you know, individual events, but what we've seen in general, as the atmosphere is warmed, more of the rain falls in heavier events, and that's fairly characteristic over the last several decades. Gavin, you want to add something?
Sure. I mean, we've already seen, attribution of certain extremes to the warmer temperatures, particularly heat waves, which is the kind of obvious one. The loss of Arctic sea ice, increases in sea level, the loss of mountain glaciers across the world. All of these things are directly related to the warming, and so we'll expect that to continue into 2016 and onwards as global warming continues.
Thank you.
Again, participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. Our next question comes from Thomas Sumner with Science News.
Hello. Last year, you said that 2014 had a 48% of actually being the hottest year. I'm wondering what was the confidence percentage this year?
So it depends on which data set you're looking at, but they're all well above 90%. Our data sets, we estimated there was a 94% chance of being the warmest year in reality, given the gaps in the data that we have. And Tom, what did you have?
We had over 99%, and I think in the IPCC language, we would say it was virtually certain.
Thank you.
Again, participants, that was star 1, and record your name if you'd like to ask a question at this time. One moment, speakers, to see if we have any questions. Our next question comes from Robert Holtz with the Wall Street Journal.
Yes, this is for both Gavin and Tom, if I may. I wonder if you would just, tell us a little bit more about the ocean warming that shows up in this temperature record this year. Separate from El Nino, I should say. I mean, we've talked about that a little bit, but the overall idea of the heat sink we're seeing here.
Yeah, I think. Go ahead, Gavin.
So there's two aspects here. One is what's happening at the surface, and you can see that in the maps that we showed today. For instance, you know, the Indian Ocean is persistently warm, has been now for a number of decades. The Atlantic, except for this kind of interesting cold blob in the North Atlantic, has been persistently warm. You'll see from year to year that in the tropics, in the Pacific, you're very much seeing the reflection of the El Nino or La Nina pattern. What was very exceptional this year was this blob in the North Pacific, just on the west of the U.S. continent. That's very anomalous and obviously very, very interesting. But that's slightly different to the other data sets that come out of the oceanographic community, which are tracking the amount of heat that's being incorporated into the ocean. The rate at which heat goes into the ocean is really a measure of the radiative imbalance of the whole planet. So if there's more energy coming into the system because of greenhouse gases or whatever in the top of the atmosphere, that heat, almost all of it, is ending up in the ocean. And so the rise in ocean heat content is really a function of this ongoing radiative imbalance driven in the most part by increases in carbon dioxide. And so that's a very useful validation of the theories that we have for why the planet is actually warming the way it is. Then the surface expression of that, that's much more variable year by year. But the ongoing increase in ocean heat content tells us very clearly that this is an external forcing to the system, and it's not a natural pattern of just internal variability in the ocean.
Yeah, and one thing to add to what Gavin said, you know, there's a lot of interest in that. Gavin mentioned the cold blob up in the North Atlantic, and you know, there's some evidence that the North Atlantic deep water circulation has actually slowed down. So part of that cold anomaly or departure from average you see up in the northern North Atlantic may be a reflection of that. So that's something that we have looked at in the science community, a lot of interest because it has potential implications on regional weather patterns.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Miguel with NBC News. You may begin.
Hi, guys. Good morning. Thank you very much for this this conference. Two-part question for either one of you. On the heels of today's news, what does this mean in the context of global warming, and should we also expect to see more extreme weather events in the future?
Yeah, this is Tom. I mean, I think this is, as we stated earlier, you know, the numbers that we're seeing are not at all inconsistent with what we've been seeing over the last 4 to 5 decades with this progressive increase. And, of course, as Gavin said, you know, we would have likely had a record even without El Nino, but El Nino pushed it way over the top. So we're continuing to see the increase in temperature in the order of a tenth to two-tenths of a degree C per decade. And what we would say in the future is that the change in the frequency of some of the extreme events that we've been able to link to the increased global temperatures are likely to continue. Some of the other extreme events may still take a while to separate themselves out. In particular, you know, the whole notion of, you know, what's happening with the intensity of hurricanes. Clearly, some interesting research, you know, reported last year showing that the tracks of hurricanes are moving poleward. And that's something that we haven't really looked at closely up until recently. That's something we need to keep an eye on because it has interesting other implications. Some areas may be seeing hurricanes that haven't typically experienced them, which has important implications as well.
Just I'll add one little thing. You know, we talk about extreme events like they're all one thing. They're really not. And every kind of extreme, whether it's a heat wave or a drought or a flood or a hurricane or a tornado, each of those has to be looked at very independently to determine whether there is, in fact, a climate change signal in their statistics or not. We should try and avoid talking about extreme events like they were just one thing. Some extreme events we have good evidence that they're changing as the global mean temperature changes, particularly increases in heat waves, increases in intensity of precipitation, decreases in cold air outbreaks. But then there's some other things where the science is not yet in on whether there is an effect or how quickly we'll expect to see one.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jackie Goddard with the Times of London. You may begin.
Yes, hello, and I apologize if this question has already been answered. I missed the first part of the press conference, of the teleconference. But if this trend continues, where is the Earth headed? How alarmed do we need to be? And what needs to be done to prevent us getting there?
So it's not really an if. This trend will continue. It will continue because we understand why it's happening. It's happening because the dominant forcing right now is the increase in carbon dioxide that's produced from deforestation and the burning of fossil fuels. that keeps on increasing. This year was the last year that CO2 will go below 400 ppm as part of the seasonal cycle. People obviously are talking about how to change that trajectory, and obviously the Paris negotiations and deal are very relevant to that. You know, we're mainly physical scientists, so we're just seeing what's going on and projecting what can go ahead. It's really up to society and policymakers to decide what to do with that information.
Thank you. As a reminder, participants, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment, speakers, as questions register. Our next question comes from Jeff Tollinson with Nature. You may begin.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about the Pacific Decadal Oscillation and how El Nino relates to that. If you've got any thoughts on the trends, it looks like that has flipped into a positive phase, perhaps. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what that means for temperatures going forward.
Yeah, I mean, this is Tom. It's you know, I think the scientific community is still trying to grapple with whether the PDO is a completely separate phenomena from El Nino, because El Nino has got a strong relationship to PDO. I know that if you try to look at PDO and global temperatures, you can come up with a variety of relationships depending on, you know, how many years you want to look at it and compare it to the PDO. My sense is that the PDO is important to continue to better understand if it's a true physical phenomena of the atmosphere and ocean, or it's rather a manifestation of some other features.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add.
Yes. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Valerie Boscovici with Reuters. You may begin.
Yes, hi. This is a question for either of you. You touched upon this before, but I just wanted to just talk again about the well below 2-degree goal set in Paris, and you know what these findings, you know, how to link these findings to, you know, pressure on lawmakers leaders to kind of revisit that target in future rounds of climate talks.
Yeah, all I could tell you is that, you know, best looking at the data with what we see over the last several decades is the warming is, you know, in the order of a tenth to two-tenths of a degree C per decade. So, you know, if you pick 0.15 and you can multiply that out, business as usual, how long it'll take you to get, given what we've already seen, as we were saying, since the latter 20 years of the 19th century compared to this year, you know, we are almost more than a degree Celsius warmer than we were the average of the last 20 years of the 20th century. So, you know, if we were to have a number of years comparable to this year, you know, we don't have very far to go to reach a 1.5.
One further point. I mean, we're already seeing the impacts of global warming now at 1 degree C. You know, it's not the 2 degree C or the 1.5 aspiration that was highlighted in Paris. Those aren't magic numbers. Nothing particularly special happens exactly at those numbers. What we are going to see is more clearer impacts as we warm. You know, we're on a trajectory because the carbon cycle is very out of balance right now. That can't be turned around instantly. There's a sustained effort that would be required to shift emissions away from carbon dioxide. And there has to be a sustained conversation and discourse and monitoring of the situation from everybody for this problem to get under control. And that's not a that's not something that's just going to be done in 1 year or 2 years, or really depends on what 2015 was or 2016 will be. But it's really something that depends on the long-term trends and our long-term ability to maintain focus on this issue.
Thank you, speakers. Our next question comes from Irene Klotz with Discovery News.
Hi, thanks very much. I think this question is probably for Gavin. Just was wondering if you all have started folding in the data from the OCO mission and what you can say anything about the specific sites of the carbon emissions and the carbon sinks. Thanks.
So, Gavin here. I don't work directly on that, though. OCO2 is part of is one of the missions that's that Goddard Space Flight Center is very heavily involved in. We haven't really seen much results from that yet. I think they're still in the processing and calibration phase. When it does really start to get processed, what we're going to see is a lot of detail that we've never seen before in terms of how carbon dioxide is varying across latitude, across geography, and hopefully improving our ability to pin down the carbon sinks that are either in the ocean or on the land surface, plants and soils, and also, you know, where the emissions are really coming from. And that will help pin down deforestation signals. It will help pin down emissions from countries where, you know, perhaps the official recording numbers are not that reliable. So we do anticipate a lot of good information from that, but it hasn't quite come online yet.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jeff Brumville with National Public Radio.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my question. Sort of, I think, a simpler version of Jeff Tollefson's question, which is simply, do we know if there's a connection between El Nino and the warming planet at this point? I mean, what's the state of knowledge on that?
Gavin here. So, you know, people, I mean, El Nino is a very complicated phenomena, and it has a very complicated spectra, has a very complicated dynamics. If you look at simulations of El Nino, what you see is a very chaotic pattern, and you get periods when, you know, it's very much in a La Nina mode, and then other times when it's in an El Nino mode, and sometimes when all of the variance is quite muted, and then other times when it's quite large. And it's very hard to pick out, given that variety, a small signal that of El Nino having been affected by climate change and whether that is actually the case. As far as I can tell, and I think IPCC came to pretty much the same conclusion, the jury is still out on whether the overlying climate changes that we're seeing have affected either the magnitude or other statistics of El Nino at this point. The models, like for the future, give very diverse responses, and so it's hard to know exactly what to believe there. So I think really, you know, people are just, there's a question mark there, and people are still very much interested in how that how El Nino could be affected by climate change. Whether El Nino itself is driving climate change, there the answer is much more clearly no. You can correct for El Nino, you can do all these things, and you're still left with an underlying long-term trend that's due to the increases in greenhouse gases in the most part.
Yeah, and if I could just add to what Gavin said, you know, one of the things that's clear, you know, both El Nino and La Nina, you know, they really do contribute to the bumps and wiggles you see in that time series that we've showed. And it's clear that if you try to look over too short of a time period and try to estimate what changes are, you could be misled, because certainly we do know La Nina and El Nino do contribute either positively or negatively
to the overall global temperatures.
Okay, thank you.
We have a question from Catherine Bagley with Inside Climate News. You may begin.
Hi, guys. Thanks again for hosting this call. I have a question about slides 2 and 3. When you're looking at the cool blobs, you know, just south of Greenland and in the Southern Ocean, is the idea, you know, part of the reason that's cooling is cold ice or cold meltwater coming off the ice sheets?
Yeah, this is Tom. I mean, one of the probably one of the most important reasons is that that is an area where we typically get increased warmth from the Gulf Stream, and if the amount of the deep water formation of cold water begins to shut down, that means we're not getting that warmth moving into that area. And so a large part of that that cooling is probably related to the strength of the thermal haline circulation. Also, as you mentioned, you know, we do have more cold, fresh water melting from the Greenland ice sheet. So, you know, the combination of those two set up ideal conditions for colder than normal temperatures.
So let me chime in there. We are seeing from the GRACE satellites, we can detect a loss of mass in Greenland that's ongoing year on year for the last 11 or so years, and that is actually quite a lot of meltwater. It's not really enough, given our understanding, to have a major effect on the overturning circulation as yet. But we do actually have another monitoring system, which is called the Rapid Array, which is at 26 north across the Atlantic. And that's a set of moorings that allow us to track how much water is moving north, at what depth, and where it's moving south. And that has shown a slight decrease in the last 10 years in the strength of the overturning stream function. And so we are not really sure whether that's just kind of internal variability or whether it's actually being driven. We anticipate with the model results that we have going forward out to like 2100, we do anticipate a slowdown in that circulation, but we don't anticipate it quite yet. So it has that same fingerprint in terms of the sea surface temperatures, but we're still unsure as to what its persistence is going to be like and what the attribution is of that anomaly. That's certainly something to be looking at as we go forward in future years.
Great. Thanks, guys.
We have a question from Matt Smith with Vice News. Your line is open.
Hi there. I was wondering if anybody's run numbers on what the odds would be of having two record years in a row, or potentially three if 2016 holds up.
So I haven't done an odds calculation, but it's not unprecedented to have 2 years in a row, 97, 98, 40, 41, and there was 88, 89, I think, as well. So that's happened before. In our record, we've never had 3 years in a row. So if 2016 actually turns out to be as warm as we anticipate, then that would be three in a row, and that would be unprecedented in our record. And then I agree, that would be worth somebody jumping in and seeing what the odds are for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, speakers. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1, record your name. Our next question comes from Sophie with NBC News. You may begin.
Yes, hi there. In reference to slide 3, you're saying that in the U.S., the second warmest year, the U.S. 2015 is the second warmest year and the third wettest year. Can you provide the data of the first, of when the warmest year was and the wettest year was for?
Yeah, you know, the warmest year was 2012, and that, you know, we really smashed the records. If you remember, We had an extremely warm spring in that year, and that just recently broke the all-time highest temperatures for the contiguous U.S. The actual wettest year, we would have to get back to you on that. I'm not looking at the statistics right now in terms of what the wettest year is, but if you would like, I'm sure Deke Arndt can provide you what the wettest year was.
Hi, this is Katie Matthews. If you can send me an email, and I'll give my email at the end, I'll make sure you get that information.
Great, thank you.
Our next question comes from Emily Gertz with Participant Media. You may begin.
Hi, thanks for having this press conference. I think this question's for Gavin, but both of you should feel free to take a run at it. Given that we are already now at 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial and early industrial era temperatures, and given the degree of the acceleration that you're showing in some of these charts, is a 2 degree Celsius rise pretty much already baked into the system? Or could a, you know, if somehow the world, you know, accumulated the will to ramp down fossil fuels faster, could that still be averted?
So, Gavin here. One of the things that's become clearer in recent years is that the eventual warming of the planet is actually quite closely controlled by the total amount of carbon dioxide we're going to put into the atmosphere. That's this notion of the carbon budget. And the reason that works is because carbon dioxide is long-lived in the atmosphere. The perturbations from an emission now persist for hundreds and thousands of years. And so, you know, we haven't quite caught up with what we've already done, and we're continuing to do more. If you look at the pathways that people have suggested for scenarios that would keep us below 2 degrees or below 1.5 degrees even, those are pathways that require emissions to be cut pretty much starting from now at historically unprecedented rates. You know, people are coming up with scenarios that suggest that these things are possible. It's you know, it's not quite my field, so I don't know how possible these things are. But as part of the physical climate aspect of that, sustained reductions in emissions to about, you know, an 80% cut within the next 30 years would probably do it. But that's a very ambitious target, it seems to me. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, this is Tom. I would just add, you know, it certainly is important to focus on, you know, these threshold values. But just as important is to be concerned about the rate at which the temperature changes. So, you know, that's one of the things. If you look at the IPCC reports, you know, we have a difficult time establishing what we call the transient climate sensitivity. That is, so what will the global temperatures be with a certain amount of emissions, even though we haven't doubled, for example, carbon dioxide? You know, when carbon dioxide gets close to being doubled, what's the global temperature change? Then if you stop emissions then and you actually double CO2 concentrations, you continue to warm the planet, as Gavin said. And the real issue with these different scenarios for how carbon in the atmosphere increases, it's important to consider not only the target, but just how quickly you get there, because from the standpoint of impacts, it makes it much more difficult to adapt to a rapidly changing climate than something that's happening more slowly.
Thank you. This is Katie Matthews again. I want to appreciate, thank everyone for being on today's call. Unfortunately, we do need to end. If we were not able to get to your question, I'm going to give you again my email coming up here in just a second. You can feel free to send me your question, and we'll make sure that it gets answered. So, again, if you have further follow-up questions from today's call on the NOAA side, you can email me at Katie, K-A-T-Y, dot Matthews, M-A-T-T-H-E-W-S, at NOAA, N-O-A-A, dot gov. On the NASA side, you can contact Michael Cabbage and Leslie McCarthy at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Their emails are mcabbage at nasa.gov and Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, dot M, dot McCarthy, M-C-C-A-R-T-H-Y, at nasa.gov. Do note that the audio for today's call will be available on the NOAA Media Advisory in 1 to 2 hours. And finally, I do want to note that NOAA is also hosting a Spanish language call for media and constituents today at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. That media advisory can also be found on www.noaa.gov/media.html. We really appreciate everyone's participation, and this concludes today's call. Yomi, if you could end the call for us.
Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please stand by for the post-conference.